Hi, I'm Rob Nesbitt, and this is the ProCartoon.com podcast. I look at the tools of the trade, tips, tricks, podcast reviews and interviews, and more to help you in your cartooning and artistic work. In this episode of the ProCartoon podcast, having received so many listener questions, I'm devoting time to answer as many that you've sent in as possible. Before we go into the main filling of this ProCartoon podcast pie to answer your listener questions, a quick personal update. I've been slightly derailed from my target goals due to a sales opportunity that has come my way unexpectedly. Shortly after that, another opportunity arrived and my best laid plans will require some revision. I've been approached by a major brass band website, 4barsrest.com, to sell my cartoon related products on their website shop. Since then, I've spent quite a lot of time preparing products and the sales copy to go on their shop page. To kick things off, I'm going to sell signed prints, limited edition prints, and original artwork. This has been an excellent income stream in the past, and as you already know, I'm an advocate of creating multiple streams of income to safeguard the business against any unexpected or sudden downturn. Prints are a very good product for cartoonists, as once you've created the original artwork, it can be reproduced over and over. If you'd like more information on creating professionally prepared prints, see my article, How to Sell My Artwork, and the link is in the show notes. I'll also sell original artwork, which not only varies what is on offer, but commands a much higher price, as you would expect. Another variation is to create limited edition prints. These will be hand-signed with a unique edition number. Limited editions add scarcity to the mix, and as such, you can charge more than a straightforward print, and it can be quite lucrative. More recently, I've been approached by a high-end custom pen manufacturer. I've been asked to design a series of cartoons that will be implanted in the barrels of Click and Fountain pens for a new range of pen designs. Ritterswriters.com is owned by Gareth Ritter, who is based in Raglan, a small rural village in Monmouthshire in the UK. Between these two recent ventures, the time I have available to move my existing goals on has been eaten up. I've had to rethink and look at rescheduling. As Brian Tracy says in his best-selling self-help book, Goals, if you can't meet a deadline, then set another. I'm taking this advice, but it does feel as if I've failed slightly. I'm sure I'll get over that feeling, as this failure is for some very positive reasons. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep producing the podcast, which is my top priority. I missed my target of 2 a month, as I didn't produce any in February, but I will get back on track with that. My children's picture book was to be finished in June, but I'll knock that back to late July, early August. And the Driftwood figures will also be pushed back to September. On saying that, I might just put them on the 4barsrest.com shop as additional products. It's funny how things progress when you start to really drill down and focus on developing your business. Other opportunities seem to come out of the blue. I'll keep you posted. Before I answer your questions, here's a shout out from the ProCartoon sponsor JohnOverall.com, who hosts the ProCartoon.com website.
With all the changes in website requirements, pulled, compromised, and abandoned plugins out there, now is the time to update and upgrade your WordPress website. JohnOverall.com has 20 plus years experience and offers hosting, maintenance programs, support, and more to keep your site up to date and running smoothly. We offer free estimates and only bill you for the time used, not by the block. While you're caring for your business, let JohnOverall.com care for your website. Think of us when you think of WordPress. Visit JohnOverall.com.
You can see the show notes and the transcription of the podcast at ProCartoon.com on the podcast page. Okay, let's dive straight into the podcast. Now it's your turn as I look at the deluge of questions you've sent in. I'm really grateful to every one of you that's taken the time out to contact me. It really is much appreciated, and I have to say you've sent in some great questions. I love this interaction as it shows me that there are people who listen to the podcast, and it also keeps me on my toes. It has also given me ideas for future articles and podcasts, as you ask things that trigger more ideas for me. Okay then, the first question is from Mike James, who is from Auckland in New Zealand. Mike asks, I've just started to draw cartoons and wondered if the characters I hope to create should be anatomically correct. I've read a book on cartoon and it talks about variations such as only having three fingers on hands. What is your opinion of this? Great question, Mike, and it opens up much for discussion. Characters do not have to be anatomically correct, let's get that straight. Cartooning is all about imagination, so if you vary slightly, it really doesn't matter. On the subject of fingers, the great Walt Disney's most famous character, Mickey Mouse, has only three fingers. Why? Because it makes the animation less complicated and clumsy with three. So, the three-fingered approach. I generally use three fingers and a thumb for my brass band cartoons for very much the same reason, and because most brass valve instruments only have three valves. On the other hand, excuse the terrible pun, I usually depict conductors with a full set of four fingers and a thumb while conducting with a baton. The reason is I make full use of the fingers to create expression and movement in the hands. Another anatomical anomaly, and try saying that when you're not sober, are the eyes, particularly when drawing cartoon characters' faces side on. Lynn Chapman is the talented British children's book illustrator and urban artist, draws both eyes side on, even though it would in reality not be anatomically correct. She calls it three-quarter face, and the reason she does it is because two eyes on the character are far more interesting than one. There's an example of one of her illustrations in the show notes showing exactly this. You can also see clearly that the little girl in the image has only three fingers and a huge head in proportion to her body. I think this demonstrates quite nicely that reality can go out the window for a cartoonist. If you'd like to listen to Lynn Chapman and see some more of her work, go to the Pro Cartoon Podcast 1, where there's a fascinating interview I did with Lynn last summer. I hope that answers your question, Mike. The next question comes from Chicago, and Sally Cook asks, if I draw for prolonged periods, I have a really bad backache, and I often have to stop drawing for days at a time. This is particularly frustrating when I need to get work finished on a deadline. Have you any ideas how we can overcome this problem, as I've tried everything? I assume it is caused by the way I'm sat at my kitchen table, which is where I do most of my artwork. Okay, welcome to my world, Sally. I am currently visiting the chiropractor after doing something to my back while clearing snow from my driveway. It is murder to sit for any length of time and frustrating as I have quite a heavy workload at the moment. There's no easy answer to this, but there are many things you could try, and please forgive me if you've tried these before. Firstly, try an ergonomic chair or desk setup. There are many on the market, and I would suggest that if you are going to do this, you should go to a physical shop rather than online shop so that you can test this out. Try standing and drawing on a higher work surface, such as a kitchen worktop. Vary the angle that you're drawing at. I've found that a slight incline rather than a flat surface doesn't give me so much grief, and I don't suffer so much with a backache then. Exercise. Exercise regularly, I've found walking to be the best medicine for any backaches and pains. Walking helps posture and is very good for you. I aim to do at least 10,000 steps a day on my Fitbit watch, which is a great motivational tool. Diet and losing weight have been pivotal in keeping my back pain away. When I am at my comfortable weight, I generally feel fine with very few aches and pains. When I put on too much, which in my case is about a stone, I feel gross and get all sorts of aches that I didn't know I had places. Also, Joanna Penn is a prolific fiction writer but also writes very good self-help books for writers. Her recent book, The Healthy Writer, is excellent with some great information and tips on keeping healthy. If you think about it, a writer sits in basically the same posture, and Joanna's book is highly applicable to us cartoon artists. If you're interested in getting a copy of the book, there is a link in the show notes. I hope that helps, Sally, and hopefully you'll be able to get back to normal soon. There's nothing worse than back pain apart from toothache, particularly when you're trying to be creative. Right, the next question comes from Kelly in Miami. And Kelly asks, is it better to draw cartoons on a larger scale than reduced down to make them look more professional? This is an interesting question, and there are two answers to this, yes and no. Have I confused you already? I'll start with yes. I often use international paper size A3 when I have a larger or complex scene to draw. It gives me more room to draw and I can get in the detail without it becoming fuzzy or scratchy. I then scan the image in two or more sections and stitch it then back together using the layers palette in Photoshop. It's easy to align the separate sections then in layers. Just drop the opacity of a layer so that you can see the layer beneath and you can move them exactly into position with the Move tool. This works really well for me, however, other artists work in different ways, so here is where the No answer comes into play. It may not suit your style of work to draw in a larger format and then rescale. One of my favourite artists is the highly talented Australian children's book illustrator Corky Paul. He has illustrated the Winnie the Witch series of children's picture books. Each illustration is packed to the rafters with detail and subplots. You keep finding something new, interesting or hidden every time you take another look. It's simply staggering the amount of intricate and quirky detail that he manages to get on a page. I had the pleasure of talking to Corky Paul a few years back at the world-famous Hay on Wye Literary Festival. I asked him what scale he prepared his artwork for the box. I was absolutely astounded when he said that they were the same scale as they appear in the box. He didn't use a larger format and shrink it later. I was absolutely convinced that he was going to tell me he drew and painted on huge canvases, but not so. You could see some examples of his work on the Winnie the Witch box in the show notes. If it suits you to draw small or large, it doesn't really matter. It's what feels right for you. In my case, I usually draw at the size it will appear when published. But on occasion, as I said earlier, it will make sense to scale them up, then back down to grab in and lock the detail. I hope that answers your question, Kelly. Right, from Miami, we head northeast to Manchester in New Hampshire, where Ed asks, what do I need to do to create a portfolio to show to potential customers? How many pieces of artwork do I need to include, and what is the best way to present it? Thanks, Ed, for your 3-in-1 question. You've raised some great issues here. A portfolio is usually the last thing we cartoonists think about while we are beavering away creating awesome cartoon work. That is, until we need to present our work to a prospect. I found this really stressful and time-consuming the first time I had to put a portfolio together and present it. So bad, in fact, it made me feel quite ill. But fear not. I'll take your questions in a different order. Let's start with how many pieces of artwork do you need? I generally tailor this to suit the client, their project or trade, and any other relevant factors that could influence what they're looking for. As an example, I once pitched a printing company who had already done some work for me in the past. I verbally pitched myself while buying some printed material from them, and the main man asked me to bring in a portfolio of work. In this case, I produced quite a large portfolio of varied work, which included ideas for printed materials that he could use for his customers. This worked very well, and I also prepared a professional portfolio that he in turn could show his clients if they needed artwork. He directed his customers to me or simply took orders and took a cut for himself. This arrangement worked really well. In a second example, I pitched a magazine editor, and it was more appropriate to send him 3 cartoons in a specific niche related directly to the magazine content. I sent the cartoons in an email, so there was no hard copy portfolio in this pitch. It worked and I got the magazine's cartoonist job. So Ed, you can see that there is no set or standard portfolio size. It all depends on the circumstances you are presented with. I've also created a portfolio as a PowerPoint presentation, which worked superbly for another client. If you're meeting a client face-to-face, make sure you display it professionally. What I mean is, you don't want to turn up like you just crawled through Edge backwards with your artwork in a plastic shopping bag. I generally use a larger scale as International Paper A3 plastic wallet folder. This keeps the artwork firmly in place and looks the business. I also keep that inside an artist's portfolio carrier. If you want to see some great examples, I've done a review of 5 top-rated portfolio cases, and again, the link is in the show notes. By being prepared and looking professional, you'll feel professional, more confident, and more likely to win over your prospect. So there we are. I think I've covered all your questions, Ed, and I hope it helps. The next question is from Corin in New Orleans. And Corin says, I'm about to launch my own cartoon-based website and will feature a lot of my artwork and graphics. Is there anything I can do to stop people downloading my material for their own use? Hi Corin, that's a great question. This was an issue that used to really bug me when I launched my first website in 2002. At that time, website building and the technicalities that go with it were a complete mystery to me. I asked the web designer the same question that you have. His solution was to disable right-click. In other words, if someone tried to steal my artwork by using the right mouse click copy or tried to copy off the top menu, they couldn't. Now, that worked fairly well then. The thing is that we've come a long way since then, and if people want to steal your artwork, they can. It isn't rocket science. The best way to protect your work is to watermark it. It won't stop people downloading it, but it is more likely to stop those crooks who steal your work to make their own product. An image with a watermark is not desirable to, say, someone who wants to rip your design off for a t-shirt or a greetings card. I've come to the conclusion that most folk are basically honest, but I accept that a few rogues have ripped off my artwork from time to time. Has it made a devastating dent in my income? Certainly not, and I don't really think it's worth worrying about. I also feel quite flattered that some people think my cartoons are good enough to steal. If someone did use my artwork and was selling products with my work on without my agreement, then I would start the ball rolling for communication to stop them from using the design, or at least a discussion what they are doing and come to an arrangement. If this fails, I would follow it up with a letter from a lawyer to cease and desist, which large corporations generally do when there have been copyright infringements, such as using a brand name in a title of your website. You've also given me an idea for an article on Pro Cartoon, how to create an effective watermark. So thanks, Corin, and I hope you don't get too wound up about others using your art. Just another bit of information for you. There's another section in the Cartoonist Guidebook, Drawing on the Funny Side of the Brain by Christopher Hart, that deals with the protection of your artistic ideas. If you look in the show notes, I describe the book in more detail in the next listener's question, and there is a link if you want to buy this invaluable book online. Before I move into the next topic, here's a shout out to all cartoonists who would like some free advertising for their products or services. If you're a cartoonist and would like to advertise your services, I'm setting up a section on procartoon.com for cartoonists and other artists to showcase their talents. The first 10 that apply will get free ad placement. To apply, simply contact me, Rob Nesbitt, via the contact page on procartoon.com. Send me an outline of what you do, what you have to offer, plus contact details, and I will send out the format to submit your free ad space, which will be a page to yourself plus images of your work, contact details, etc. If you sign up for the Pro Cartoon newsletter, you'll be kept up to date with new articles and features. As a subscriber, you will automatically be entered in our regular prize draws. Just visit the About page on procartoon.com to sign up for the newsletter. I'm also on the lookout for cartoonists to interview on this podcast. The only criteria I have is that either you are a published cartoonist — what I mean by that is you're paid regularly for your work in national magazines, newspapers, online, or maybe a children's book illustrator — or you have a cartoon-related or art-related business that would be of interest and relevance to our readers and subscribers. Send me a short message via the procartoon.com contact page and we can discuss a podcast. Okay, back to the plot. Now, we sail across the pond to the UK, where Simon asks, "I find it very difficult to draw expression in the faces of my cartoon characters. Is there a book or course I can use to help me?" Simon, that's another great question, and it is an issue I have struggled with myself when I first got into cartooning. There are a few good books which help with the basics of cartooning and several courses. However, there's one book that I swear by and I think is a masterclass in creating cartoon expression. Peter Maddox is a British cartoonist whose work was regularly seen in all British newspapers, the Daily and Sunday Express in particular. He wrote a cartoonist self-help book called So You Want to Be a Cartoonist, and I still have my copy, which is donkey's years old now. I still regularly refer to it for guidance and inspiration. He shows the basics in such a fabulous way that is not like learning a subject. He literally drags you in and inspires you on every page. I can see his illustrations on how to draw hands, facial expression, movement lines, and all other cartoony facets without opening a page. It's locked away in my head. That's the good thing. Now the problem, it is becoming more and more difficult to get hold of this book. Since it was first published in 1982, copies are getting scarce. However, I was delighted to see that there is now a Kindle version, and there now seems to be a reprint, which you can find at Amazon using the link in the show notes. There is also another excellent cartoonist how-to book, and every cartoonist should have this in the reference library as well. Christopher Hart has created a superbly illustrated reference book that takes you from the very basics through the development of characters, action, expression, and just about every aspect of drawing, selling, and giving you the skills that you need. This is a book that I regularly delve into to refresh and enthuse my creative mind. Christopher is well qualified to produce this fantastic cartoonist guide, having attended the Disney Animation Programme at the California Institute of Arts and earned himself a BA from the New York University's Film School. He has worked in the world-famous Blondie comic strip, regular contributions to Mad Magazine, and has written comedies for many of the top TV and film studios such as MGM, Paramount, Fox and NBC. I just love the way that he's laid out the 200 pages in this book. Any aspect for the aspiring cartoonist is covered. If you want to know how to turn animal anatomy into cartoon anatomy, it's there. If you want to know how to submit your cartoon strip or how to protect your creative work, it's there. You can purchase Christopher Hart's book online using the link in the show notes. Move on now to cartoon courses. There are many courses to be found on the internet, some good, some not so good. One course I've bought and completed recently, which I thought was exceptionally good, was Lynn Chapman's Expressive Picture Book Characters. Lynn is an excellent communicator and teacher, and even though I've been drawing for most of my life, I learnt a lot from her and found many new ideas, tips and tricks. There are 7 high-quality video lessons in the course, and Lynn talks and walks you through the following topics: creating human characters, creating animal characters, dressing your characters, adding character and emotion, adding body language, creating a sense of movement, and placing characters in context. The course is available on craftsy.com and won't cost you a fortune. Moving on, Ben from Rhode Island in the US asks, is it better to pencil my cartoons out in rough first and ink in later, or should I dive straight in with a pen to force myself to get better? Ben, I know exactly where you're coming from with this. I used to believe that I was not a good cartoonist because I had to rough pencil my cartoons first. That was until I started to look at some of the top cartoonists' original work. I started to collect original cartoons by some of the best British cartoonists. One of the most famous was Reg Smythe, who created a northern cartoon character called Andy Cap. It was a cartoon strip that featured in the Daily Mirror for over 4 decades and was so popular that even after Reg Smythe's death in 1998, the Daily Mirror kept the cartoon strip going using writer Roger Kettle and artist Roger Mahoney. I was lucky enough to acquire 2 of his original submissions to the Daily Mirror on eBay. I was delighted to see the traces of pencil in the background, behind the finished inking. Even the very best use pencil to make sure it gets drawn correctly. At the end of the day, does it really matter whether you pencil it out first? Surely it's the finished article that counts. The one unknown in this lies in your question. Would diving straight in with ink improve your drawing skills? This is a very good question that I'm not really in a position to answer with any authority, as I have not tried this. I watched the incredible Quentin Blake, who's the illustrator of Roald Dahl's wonderful children's box, live at a workshop several years ago. I noted that he drew directly with a pen, no pencil in sight. I think this is because he has a style that suits this method, with a scratchy pen that absolutely suits a dip pen on paper. In addition, I think the man is an absolute artistic genius, who seems to be able to create unimaginable personality and expression out of such an economy of seemingly random pen strokes. When Quentin is drawing for a book illustration, he takes a slightly different approach. First, he does a rough of the illustration on thin paper. He then places the rough drawing on a light box and places watercolour paper over the top. He says that he can see the outline of the rough drawing below, but not so much that he copies it as you would with tracing paper. He says that he is really drawing it again as if for the first time. Otherwise, you don't get the expressions right. You can see this process and how Quentin colours in his illustrations in a short video I've posted on the show notes, which I found absolutely fascinating. Thanks for that question, Ben. I'm sure a lot of new cartoonists will really appreciate this. Right, moving down under to Australia, we have Terry Young from Queensland. He has a question on cartoon style. How do I develop my own cartooning style? I've been drawing cartoons for a couple of years, but always seem to copy other cartoonists' styles. This is another great question, and I think fairly easy to answer. We've all been through some form of development in our lives, and yes, others influence how we shape things. Time is the secret here. Remember when you were learning to write? In those early days, your childlike writing looked nothing like your writing style as an adult. It took years to refine and develop. I look back at my early cartoons and see how far I've progressed since then. I used to look at a great variety of cartoonist styles in minute detail to see how they were doing it. Over time, I took the best parts of my favourite cartoonist, and slowly but surely, it morphed into a style which I believe is part influenced, but mainly my own style of drawing now. Trust me on this, if you keep that pen in action and turn out a lot of work, your style will come. Don't worry that you think you're copying other artists, as it's just part of the long-term development. As a benchmark, take a look at the cartoons you've been turning out a couple of years ago. Has the style changed? Have you improved? My guess is yes on both counts, and I'm pretty sure that in a few years down the line, you will look back and see further developments. It can take quite a long time to lock in your own distinctive style, but once it arrives, you will know it. I think this is generally the case for all cartoonists. Thanks for that question, Terry, and I hope your individual style arrives soon for you. Right, we fly back to the US of A. Jenny from Chattanooga asks, when I scan in my black and white pen cartoons, they never appear as good on screen in Photoshop. Is there an easy way to solve this problem, or do I need to buy a new scanner? Hi Jenny, don't spend any money just yet on a new scanner. This is just one of those quirks you get with most scanners when the scanned image seems to be a poorer version of the original. Very often the scan on screen can have a slightly grey tinge and appear a little washed out. The easiest way to correct this is to open up the layers palette in Photoshop. You can see an image that I've put in the show notes. In the layers palette, duplicate the scanned layer. Then in the layers menu, select multiply. This has the effect of combining and strengthening the colour of the both top and bottom layers. If it looks too harsh, use the opacity slider in the layers palette to reduce the opacity of the top layer till you get the desired effect. Once this is done, open the layer menu at the top of the screen and select flatten. This will merge the two layers together with your desired level of blackness of line. That's it. A couple of mouse clicks and you're all done. I hope that solves the issue for you, Jenny, and has saved you from having to buy a new scanner. Okay, we move on to the very last question for this edition of the podcast, and this is from Donna in Vancouver, Canada. I want to produce my own cartoon Christmas cards using my own printer. The problem is my printer is hit and miss and often misfeeds, making it so unreliable that I feel like giving up. Can you recommend a printer that will cope with a heavier card? Thanks for the question, Donna. I had the self-same problem with my last printer. Manufacturers make me laugh and curse at the same time. They make wild claims about what their products can do. The reality is often way off the mark. My last printer, made by one of the leading printer brands, was supposed to print up to 300 GSM. It struggled to print half that weight of paper. I don't produce a great deal of greetings cards using my own printer for that very reason. I now tend to outsource. There are some very reasonable prices out there for not so large quantities. Years ago, you had to buy tens of thousands of cards to make the unit cost for each one viable. With the advancement of technology, smaller runs are normal practice, and you can get top quality greetings cards with your own designs for the right price. I recently used printed.com, who produce quality prints on a range of quality papers and cards. It's worth shopping around to see what bargains you can get. If you're determined to print your own cards, I would suggest you get a printer with ink reservoirs rather than cartridges. It will save you a fortune and bring the unit cost for each printed card down considerably. My current printer is an Epson ET3600, which is a combi printer and scanner with refillable ink reservoirs. I've given it a real hammering for over 12 months and have only just recently refilled the black tank. The other three colour tanks are still at least half full. Yes, the refills are expensive, but in the same time period, I would have got through several sets of cartridges, which I estimate would have been quadruple the cost. It generally feeds heavier paper without a problem, but occasionally plays up. If there's anyone out there who could recommend a trouble-free printer that can handle a card of up to 300 GSM or heavier, please get in touch and let me know. I would rather hear from experience than rely on a manufacturer's dodgy claim. Thanks for that, Dolan, and I hope you were successful with your Christmas cards. Okay, so that just about wraps things up for the show. Looking forward to edition 5 of the podcast. I'll be reviewing a really good set of watercolour pencils, a great tip to add professional finishing touch to your cartoons, and much more.